August 14th, 1986. Myrtle Point, Oregon. 14-year-old Jeremy Bright attends a county fair with his younger sister, but after promising to meet her at a scheduled time, he does not show up and is never heard from again. Various rumors start to circulate about what happened to Jeremy, including that he was accidentally shot to death by some local bullies who covered up the crime and buried his body. Even though one of these bullies would soon go to prison for an unrelated murder, no one is conclusively linked to Jeremy's disappearance, and he continues to remain a missing person. After that, the trail went cold. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the latest episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host, Robin Warder, and we've got another Unsolved Mysteries case to feature today, the 1986 disappearance of 14-year-old Jeremy Bright. Throughout the course of this podcast run, I've always referred to moments from Unsolved Mysteries which made a vivid impression on me while I was growing up. One of them was a reenactment from a segment about this case, where Jeremy Bright, who wasn't much older than me when I originally watched this, is lying on a cot inside a desolate cabin, recovering from a gunshot wound. They then cut to the people who shot him, carrying Jeremy's body through the woods at night, looking for a place to bury him. Of course, this was just a reenactment of a rumored scenario, and I have no idea if this is what actually happened, but nevertheless, it still freaked me out at the time. Anyway, today's episode is a disturbing story about a teenage boy who went missing after attending a county fair. It takes place in one of those small towns where everyone seems to have a good idea about who was responsible, and Jeremy's family have been forced to listen to a number of horrific rumors about what happened to him. But here we are, 3 decades later, and no one has ever been charged in relation to Jeremy's case, and his body has still not been found. So we're going to explore his disappearance on this episode, and try to figure out the most likely explanation for what happened to him. However, before we get started, just a quick reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast, which is currently available for download on several platforms, including iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play Music, and Spotify. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it, and please leave us a rating or a review on any of those sites to help spread the word and garner us more exposure. The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so if you would like to learn how to support the show, please visit our page at patreon.com/thetrailwentcold. For as little as $1 a month, you can garner access to exclusive rewards, which may include stickers and thank you cards, early access to episodes, and bonus content. So with all that out of the way, let us now delve into the unsolved disappearance of Jeremy Bright. Our story begins in Oregon in 1986. Our central figure is 14-year-old Jeremy Bright, who lives in the town of Grants Pass with his mother, Diane Bright, and his 9-year-old sister, Esty. Both children originally grew up in Myrtle Point, a small town of around 2,600 people located over 100 miles away in Coos County. After Diane's marriage to Jeremy and Esty's father came to an end, she got married to Orville Gulsa, who went by the nickname Oli, but the relationship would also end in a divorce. After accepting a new job in Grants Pass, Diane decided to move there with her 2 kids. Jeremy is preparing for his first year of high school, but one of his traditions while living in Myrtle Point was to attend the annual Coos County Fair, which came to town for a week every summer. Since this particular year was going to be the 75th edition of the fair, Jeremy really wanted to go, so Diane agreed to allow him and Esty to return to Myrtle Point to stay with her stepfather Oli for the week. On August 14th, the fair was holding Kids' Day, so Jeremy took Esty and a friend of hers there and brought them both all-day passes for the rides. At around 2 p.m., they went their separate ways, but Jeremy arranged to meet Esty at the Ferris wheel at 5 o'clock. Many of Jeremy's relatives still lived in Myrtle Point, so he spent the next few hours helping out his aunt at a restaurant she had recently purchased and was planning to open in the near future. At 4:45, Jeremy called his mother at a payphone in order to make arrangements for her to pick him and Esty up 2 days later. He said he was going to go meet Esty and ended the call. Now, there is conflicting information about the timeline of what happened next. At some point, Jeremy stopped by a tavern owned by his uncle, as his grandmother and stepfather just happened to be there at the time, so Jeremy asked Oli if he could borrow some money to attend the fair the following day. Some sources say this took place immediately after Jeremy's phone call to Diane, but the Unsolved Mystery segment states that this took place at 9:40 p.m. That doesn't seem to make much sense, since Jeremy was scheduled to meet his sister at 5 o'clock, but he did not show up, so where would he have been during that 5-hour window? Whatever the case, when Jeremy took Oli's money and exited the tavern, this turned out to be the last time anyone from his family saw him alive. Anyway, Esty and her friend went to the Ferris wheel at 5 p.m. as planned in order to meet Jeremy, but he never arrived. Esty approached a police officer who was patrolling the fairgrounds to tell him about this, but he told her not to worry, because Jeremy was probably just off hanging out with friends. At the time, Esty was not overly concerned, so both she and her friend decided to walk home. On August 16th, Diane made the trip from Grants Pass and arrived at Oli's house. She discovered that Jeremy's wallet, a watch he had recently purchased, and the keys to their apartment were resting on top of the TV set, but Jeremy himself was nowhere to be found. Oli worked as a logger, and always had to wake up before dawn to leave for work, so he kept different hours than Jeremy. He had not actually seen Jeremy since he stopped by the tavern 2 days earlier, and just assumed he had been spending the night at a friend's place. Esty also confirmed to Diane that she had not actually seen her brother in 2 days. The last time she saw Jeremy, she remembered seeing him speak with two guys whom she did not recognize. None of Jeremy's friends or relatives seemed to have any idea where he was, so when evening hit, and Jeremy still didn't turn up, Diane became concerned and contacted the Myrtle Point Police Department. However, they would not file a missing persons report for Jeremy, believing that he had simply decided to take off for a while. Believe it or not, in the words of Robert Stack, they thought that Jeremy might have, quote-unquote, succumbed to the romantic allure of the carnival and assured Diane that he would probably resurface once the Coos County Fair ended. Of course, Diane thought this idea was ridiculous, since it would have been very uncharacteristic of Jeremy to abandon his younger sister. The following day, the fair closed down and left town, but there was still no sign of Jeremy. It would still be days before the police decided to launch an official investigation, and Jeremy's disappearance did not receive any coverage in the local newspaper until August the 19th, 5 days after he was last seen. During this time period, Jeremy's friends and family would pretty much have to search for him themselves and posted up missing persons flyers. They spoke with numerous people who recalled seeing Jeremy on August the 14th, the day he was last seen by his family, but no one could confirm seeing him on the 15th or after. Well, once the police finally got involved, it wasn't long before numerous rumors started circulating around the community about what happened to Jeremy. It was common for parties to take place in Myrtle Point all throughout the week of the fair, and multiple witnesses would place Jeremy at a couple of these parties. There were unconfirmed rumors that Jeremy was given a beer which had been laced with a powerful, illegal drug. Since Jeremy had a heart murmur, this could have potentially caused a fatal overdose, so perhaps whoever was responsible decided to cover the whole thing up and hide his body. However, the most disturbing story came from a jailhouse informant who told police they had heard that Jeremy and his friends had gone to a local swimming hole when three older individuals from the area, with a reputation for being troublemakers, showed up to harass them. One of them had a gun and decided to show off by firing some shots into the water as quote-unquote target practice, but one of the bullets accidentally struck Jeremy. He was left seriously wounded, so these three individuals took Jeremy to a remote cabin in the woods, located approximately 10 miles outside of Myrtle Point. Rather than summon medical attention, they attempted to nurse Jeremy back to health on their own for the next week or two, but he eventually succumbed to his wounds and died from either blood loss or infection. The perpetrators then took Jeremy's body and buried him in a shallow grave about 200 feet away from the cabin. The three individuals named in this story had kept popping up in many of the rumors surrounding what happened to Jeremy, and during her Unsolved Mysteries interview, Diane described them as, quote-unquote, not exactly what anybody would call pillars of society. Well, the authorities did perform a search of the cabin and the surrounding wooded area, but could find no sign of Jeremy. The problem is that most of the rumors circulating through the area were fourth and fifth hand rumors, and there didn't seem to be anybody who directly witnessed any of these alleged events and could corroborate the stories. But there were two incidents to suggest that something really bad might have happened. At around midnight on August 15th, the day after Jeremy was last seen, a young woman named Cecilia Fish was leaving her sister's apartment alongside a friend when one of the three individuals named in the swimming hole story came into the building's lobby. According to Cecilia, he had a substantial amount of blood on his clothing, and when she asked what happened, he simply laughed and replied, "This happened hours ago," before entering one of the apartments. What's extra significant here is that Cecilia's brother, Johnny, was one of Jeremy's best friends, and the two boys had been hanging out at the fair together that week. Only about a half hour after this incident took place, Johnny showed up at the same building and entered his sister's apartment. Johnny was shaking and clearly terrified about something, but would not or could not reveal what actually happened. Anyway, in spite of all the rumors surrounding Jeremy's disappearance, there was no actionable evidence to support any of them, and Jeremy could still not be found. After 3 months, the Myrtle Point Police Department finally handed the investigation over to the Coos County Sheriff's Office, though many believe that things might have gone differently if this transition had been made much earlier. The story would eventually reach Unsolved Mysteries, who produced a segment about the case, which aired on January 18, 1989. The segment originally concluded with Robert Stack mentioning that one of the three potential suspects in Jeremy's disappearance had recently been charged with an unrelated murder. Well, here's the story behind that one. On May 14, 1988, a 32-year-old mother of two named Patricia Lynn Morris was murdered shortly after leaving a tavern in the town of Bunker Hill, located about 20 miles outside of Myrtle Point. She was stabbed or slashed in her throat a total of 15 times, and it's estimated that she remained alive for as long as 8 hours, but was not discovered in time to be saved. 3.5 months later, 24-year-old Terry Lee Steinhoff was charged with the murder. Steinhoff had made sexual advances towards Morris at the tavern, but after she rejected him and left, this prompted Steinhoff to follow Morris to her residence and violently attack her. Well, Terry Lee Steinhoff had a personal connection to Jeremy Bright, as he had babysat Jeremy when he was younger. Several witnesses had recalled seeing Jeremy in a truck with Steinhoff on the day he disappeared, and he was one of the three individuals rumored to be involved in the shooting incident at the swimming hole. Steinhoff was set to go on trial for Morris's murder, but on January 17, 1989, the very day before the Unsolved Mystery segment aired, Steinhoff made the last-minute decision to plead no contest to the crime. While a no-contest plea to murder carried an automatic life sentence, Steinhoff would be eligible for parole after serving 10 years, whereas if he was found guilty at trial, Steinhoff could have received a minimum sentence of 25 years. After Jeremy went missing, investigators had attempted to question Steinhoff, but he was very uncooperative. They would make more attempts to speak to him in prison, but Steinhoff would not answer any questions about Jeremy's case. Police would also perform an extensive search of property owned by Steinhoff's family, but failed to turn up anything. All of Steinhoff's attempts at parole were denied, and he would die in prison after succumbing to a fatal heroin overdose in 2007. Authorities hoped that Steinhoff's death might compel people who were fearful of him to come forward with information, but no one ever has, and he remains a primary person of interest. By all accounts, Jeremy's friend Johnny was never the same after Jeremy went missing, and he would live a very troubled life dealing with such issues as addiction and homelessness before he passed away in 2011. In August of that year, Jeremy's family held a memorial service for him to commemorate the 25th anniversary of his disappearance, releasing 1,000 balloons containing his name and face into the air from a field at the elementary school where Jeremy used to play baseball. They pretty much stated that after all this time, they're no longer interested in seeking retribution against the people who were responsible for Jeremy's disappearance. They just want to recover his remains and bring him home. Investigators believe that Jeremy likely died on the very same day he went missing, and that his remains are still buried somewhere in Coos County. But after 3 decades, the full truth about what really happened to Jeremy is still unknown, and he continues to remain a missing person. So I guess you could say, the trail went cold. So I mentioned in the intro that the Unsolved Mysteries segment made a vivid impression on me when I originally watched it on television, as I was only a few years younger than Jeremy at the time he went missing. But even at that age, I figured it would only be a matter of time before this case was solved. I just got the impression that a number of people in the community knew what happened to Jeremy, and that sooner or later, someone would finally talk and reveal the truth. While introducing the segment, Robert Stack stated, quote, "They're not talking. But they know." Well, here we are 32 years later, and this case is still unsolved. It was assumed that people might have been keeping their mouths shut because they feared retribution from the people responsible, but even though one of the prime suspects went to prison and has since died, no one has talked. Now, before I provide my own analysis, I should mention that there's a very interesting and lengthy thread about this case at the Unsolved Mysteries message board I always frequent at the Sitcoms Online forum. Jeremy's mother Diane, his sister Esty, and Cecilia Fish, the sister of Jeremy's friend Johnny, have all stopped by to participate in that thread, and even though most of their posts are around 10 years old, they contain a lot of interesting information which answers some of the questions I've had about this case over the years. It sounds like Diane has always felt immense guilt over allowing Jeremy to return to Myrtle Point to attend the Coos County Fair that week, though there's no way she could have possibly anticipated this would happen. I should start out by addressing some issues I often discuss on this podcast, particularly when it pertains to older cases like this. I always feel it's important to not view these stories through a modern lens, and remember that it was just a much different time back then. Today, it might seem surprising that a 14-year-old boy like Jeremy would pretty much spend an entire week unsupervised and allow his 9-year-old sister and her friend to attend a fair without an adult. It probably comes across as particularly odd that when Jeremy didn't show up at his scheduled meeting place with Esty, no one became alarmed about this until his mother showed up in town 2 days later. While Myrtle Point only had a population of around 2,600 people at that time, it just sounded like one of those small towns where everyone knew each other, and in 1986, I'm guessing that no one figured that bad stuff would happen if kids were allowed to wander around the town unsupervised. Jeremy's disappearance is just one of those tragedies from that era, which caused people to become more paranoid and protective of their children. And of course, there's another unfortunate symptom of missing persons cases from this time period, which crept into this case, and that's the dreaded, police automatically assumed the victim was a runaway theory. Now, I don't know if the infamous line from Robert Stack about how Jeremy, quote-unquote, succumbed to the romantic allure of the carnival was just a line written for the show, or if the police actually said that, but either way, give me a break. It sounds like virtually all of Jeremy's possessions were left behind at his stepfather's home, and at the time Diane tried to report Jeremy missing, he'd already been gone 2 days. So if Jeremy had been seduced by the romantic allure of the carnival, shouldn't witnesses have, you know, actually seen him at the carnival during that time period? Even after the fair packed up and left town, and Jeremy still didn't surface, it sounds like the Myrtle Point Police Department took their time at actually launching a missing persons investigation. While Jeremy's family have always expressed their displeasure at how the Myrtle Point Police handled things, it sounds like they had the opposite reaction to the Coos County Sheriff's Office. Once they started handling the investigation, they seemed to take Jeremy's disappearance very seriously and have been quite diligent about trying to find him these past 3 decades. But unfortunately, because of jurisdictional issues, it took 3 months for the Myrtle Point police to turn over the investigation to them, and by that point, who knows how much crucial evidence might have been lost. Anyway, there seems to be some confusion about the exact timeline of events on the day Jeremy went missing, and it's possible that the Unsolved Mysteries segment may have contained inaccurate information. Their version is that at around 4:45 p.m., Jeremy stopped at a payphone to call his mother to arrange for her to come pick him up in 2 days. Then at around 9:40 p.m., Jeremy stopped by his uncle's tavern to borrow some money from his stepfather, and this was the last confirmed sighting of him. The segment never mentions anything about Jeremy not showing up at the fair for his planned meeting with his sister at the Ferris wheel at 5 p.m. In fact, aside from a brief mention of Jeremy having a sister, Esty is not featured at all in the Unsolved Mystery segment. I'm guessing this omission might have been intentional, as Esty was still a kid at the time, and perhaps they didn't want her being mentioned on the show in order to protect her. But all the subsequent media accounts of this case state that Jeremy stopped by the tavern shortly after his phone call while he was on the way to the fairgrounds, and that version makes more sense to me. If Jeremy went to the tavern at 9:40, then this would mean he missed his scheduled meetup with Esty and made no attempt to find her during the next 5 hours, which sounds very out of character for him. I guess it's possible that Jeremy could have simply forgotten about her, but since it sounds like he specifically mentioned that he was on his way to meet Esty during his final phone call, that seems very unlikely. So we have to assume that something happened to Jeremy during a very narrow window of time between 4:45 and 5 o'clock. When I first heard this part of the story, I found it odd that after Jeremy didn't show up, Esty didn't say anything about it for the next 2 days, but she did immediately attempt to speak to a police officer at the fairgrounds, who gave her the standard, "Oh, don't worry, he's probably off with friends, I'm sure he'll turn up soon." So Esty probably figured she'd see Jeremy again before too long. But what always struck me as even odder is that Jeremy could be missing for 2 straight days, and his stepfather Ole, who was supposed to be watching over him, did nothing about it until Diane arrived. In fact, since Jeremy's wallet, keys, and wristwatch were found inside Ole's house, I briefly pondered the idea that perhaps Ole had something to do with his disappearance. But during one of her posts on the Unsolved Mysteries message board, Diane confirmed that Ole's job as a logger required him to get up and leave for work sometime between 3 and 4 a.m., and that he was working on both of the days Jeremy was missing. So when Ole woke up on the morning of August 15th, he would have just assumed that Jeremy was sleeping and not noticed he wasn't at the house. If Ole woke up that early, then he probably went to bed early, so there would have been no reason for him to be alarmed if he returned home on the 15th and Jeremy wasn't there. Now, Ole apparently confirmed that he did notice Jeremy was not home when he woke up for work on the morning of the 16th, but just assumed he was probably spending the night at a friend's place. Again, that might seem unusual today, but this took place in a small town during an era when kids had a lot more independence, so I can understand why Ole might not have been immediately concerned. Regardless, this meant there was a large window of time when Jeremy's whereabouts were unaccounted for. The presence of Jeremy's wallet, keys, and wristwatch inside Ole's home also used to confuse me. Since Jeremy seemed to go missing while he was in town, I couldn't understand why he would return to the house and leave those items there, especially when he was supposed to be meeting his sister. But there's a simple explanation for that. Jeremy probably just never took those items with him to begin with. Diane pretty much confirmed this during one of her message board posts, as Jeremy was still a relatively young age and wasn't used to carrying a wallet, so he had a habit of leaving it at home. In fact, that might explain why he asked to borrow money from Ole at the tavern before he disappeared. And since the keys belonged to his family's apartment in Grants Pass, there really wouldn't be any reason for Jeremy to carry them with him, so I think the presence of these items does not indicate that Jeremy returned to the house at any point on August 14th. This supports the idea that something happened to Jeremy almost immediately after he left his uncle's tavern and before he reached the fairgrounds to meet up with his sister. Under different circumstances, I might be able to chalk up Jeremy's disappearance to a stranger abduction. If you go to the Charlie Project website, you'll find a number of cases where children or teenagers have gone missing after attending a fair or a carnival. Given the transient nature of the profession, there are a number of serial killers who were carnival workers and use the position in order to lure their young victims. But I have my doubts that's what happened in this case, as it seems far more likely that one or more individuals from the community, whom Jeremy may have personally known, were responsible for what happened to him. The Unsolved Mysteries segment presented 2 possible scenarios for Jeremy's disappearance, which were both fueled by rumors which had spread throughout the town and involved him being the victim of an accidental death which was covered up. One of the rumors was that Jeremy had attended a party and drank a beer which had been laced with an illegal drug which may have caused a potential overdose. Multiple witnesses apparently placed Jeremy at one or more parties in the town that week, though it doesn't sound like there was any substantiation to the overdose story. This theory would be reminiscent of the Kurt Sova case, which was featured on Unsolved Mysteries only a few months before this, and of course, was the subject of a Trail Went Cold episode. As you might recall, Kurt was another teenage boy who went missing after supposedly attending a party, and his body was found in a vacant lot 5 days later. While they could never conclusively determine how exactly Kurt died, the most prevalent theory is that Kurt's death was the result of a negative reaction to drugs or alcohol, and the people who hosted the party attempted to cover the whole thing up by nursing him back to health and disposing of his body after he passed away. The same scenario could have easily happened to Jeremy, especially since he had a heart murmur, which could have led to fatal consequences if he ingested the wrong thing. On the surface, it doesn't sound like an implausible explanation, as Jeremy was only 14 years old and not used to drinking alcohol, so I could see some jerks thinking it might be funny to slip a drug into one of his drinks. But I became a lot more skeptical of this theory once I learned that Jeremy had a scheduled meetup at the fair with Esty. If Jeremy decided to attend a party instead, then that would have meant he completely stood up his younger sister, which sounded pretty uncharacteristic of him. However, I think it's worth mentioning that while Jeremy was ordinarily a very good, responsible kid, his grades had slipped a little bit after his family's move to Grants Pass. It seems like he might have been having a difficult time adjusting to the transition of his mother's divorce and having to move to a new town and start at a new school. So investigators couldn't discount the possibility that after returning to Myrtle Point for the week without his mother and reuniting with old friends, Jeremy may have decided to cut loose and do some irresponsible things he ordinarily wouldn't have done, even if it meant abandoning his sister. But I don't think he would have mentioned meeting up with Esty during his final phone call with his mother unless he planned on following through. I think the witnesses who placed Jeremy at some parties may have been telling the truth, but they were just mistaken about the date. Remember, parties were taking place throughout Myrtle Point throughout the entire week of the fair, so perhaps Jeremy was seen at parties which took place prior to August the 14th. Of course, the other major rumor presented on Unsolved Mysteries is that Jeremy was accidentally shot at a local swimming hole by three troublemakers who were showing off by firing a gun into the water. Jeremy eventually succumbed to his wounds, and his body was buried somewhere. During her interview, Diane stated that of all the rumors she heard, she really hoped that this one wasn't true, because it would have meant Jeremy had to suffer for 2 weeks before he died. Like I mentioned in the intro, I found the reenactment of a wounded Jeremy slowly bleeding to death in a desolate cabin to be so unsettling, as well as the perpetrators carrying his body through the dark woods while looking for a place to bury him. But it's worth mentioning that the cabin and the surrounding area were searched by investigators, and they found no hard evidence to support this story. And of course, the primary source was a jailhouse informant, who are not known for being the most reliable individuals in the world. I do think there might be some elements of truth in this story, but I'm not sure Jeremy would have specifically been shot at a swimming hole. Again, it just doesn't ring true that Jeremy would just blow off a meeting with his sister to go swimming somewhere. They also made it sound like Jeremy was swimming with several friends when this incident happened, but as far as I know, no one has ever talked or corroborated this story. And that's the central problem here. All of these rumors seem to have been shared by people who heard them somewhere, but none of them personally witnessed these alleged events take place. The only eyewitness who may have actually seen something incriminating is Jeremy's friend Johnny, but we'll talk about him in a moment. For now, I think it would be a good time to discuss the individual who many people believe is the prime suspect, Terry Lee Steinhoff. Now, we know Steinhoff committed a brutal murder less than 2 years after Jeremy went missing, so he's clearly a bad guy. And Steinhoff does have a personal connection to Jeremy, since he babysat him when he was younger. So let's assume that Jeremy crossed paths with Steinhoff while he was on his way to meet Esty. There were apparently several witnesses who placed Jeremy and Steinhoff in a truck together that day, though it's unclear when exactly these sightings took place. Steinhoff might have convinced Jeremy to go somewhere with him, and if he was forceful or intimidating enough, Jeremy might have agreed to do so, even though he was supposed to meet his sister. Another source of confusion is that the last time Esty remembered seeing Jeremy, she saw him speaking with two guys she didn't recognize. Again, it's not clear when exactly this took place. Was this at around 2 p.m. when Jeremy and Esty went their separate ways? Or did Esty happen to catch a glimpse of Jeremy with these two guys closer to 5 o'clock? If Esty saw her brother speaking to two guys at 2 o'clock, then this might not have much significance, since it was confirmed that Jeremy spent most of the afternoon working with his aunt at a restaurant. I'm not sure if either of those guys Esty saw would have been Steinhoff, because he used to babysit the Bright family, so she may have been able to recognize him. Steinhoff's father was apparently a feared individual in the community, and according to one of Esty's posts on the Unsolved Mysteries message board, when he passed away, a detective attempted to question him about Jeremy's case on his deathbed, and he said he would not rat out his son. I should also mention that during Cecilia Fish's posts on the same message board, she confirmed that the man she saw in the apartment building covered in blood was not actually Steinhoff, but Steinhoff's cousin. Esty also posted that Cecilia did report the incident to the police. When they questioned this individual, he claimed that he got the blood from scratches he received during a fight with his girlfriend, though Cecilia maintained that the amount of blood she saw was too large to have been caused by scratches. There's some more confusion with the timeline here, as during her Unsolved Mysteries interview, Cecilia said this incident took place on Friday night, which would have been August the 15th, the day after Jeremy was last seen. Investigators seem to believe that Jeremy died on August the 14th, so if the blood seen on this guy's shirt was connected to the case, it's odd that he would still be wearing it around in public an entire day later. Also, the fact that Johnny showed up at his sister's apartment a half hour later and was completely freaked out seems to indicate that whatever he witnessed had taken place very recently. Everyone has always suspected that Johnny was the key to figuring out what happened to Jeremy, but whatever took place proved so traumatizing that he could just not reveal what he knew. I'm not quite sure how Johnny would have gotten mixed up with this. The Unsolved Mystery segment gives off the impression that Jeremy and Johnny were hanging out at the fair together on the same day Jeremy went missing, but we know that Jeremy spent most of that afternoon working at his aunt's restaurant, and Johnny was not with Jeremy when he stopped by the tavern to see Oli, which is the last confirmed sighting of him. So did the two friends cross paths while Jeremy was on his way to the fairgrounds to meet Esty? Perhaps Johnny was hanging out with Steinhoff and his cronies at that time, which is how they convinced Jeremy to go off somewhere with them. This could have been one of the rumored scenarios where Steinhoff was firing off a gun for target practice and Jeremy was accidentally shot. Or it could have been something a lot more disturbing. In addition to posting at the Unsolved Mysteries message board, Esty has also posted in a thread about Jeremy's case in the Web Sleuths forum, where she claims that one of the stories which has floated around is that Jeremy and Johnny were taken into the woods to be victimized, and Jeremy was murdered after he threatened to talk about what happened. Again, this is just a rumor which was spread, and I have no idea if it has any basis in reality, but if true, you can certainly understand why Johnny was left so traumatized. Like I mentioned earlier, Johnny was never the same after this, as he was apparently plagued by nightmares and lived a self-destructive lifestyle until his death in 2011. From what has been posted about him, it sounds like Johnny was able to remember things up until a certain point before he blacked out, so whatever happened might have been so awful that he completely blocked it from his memory. This is actually reminiscent of my podcast episode last week about the Keddie Cabin murders, where a 12-year-old witness, Justin Smart, spent the night in a separate bedroom while the murders took place. There's a lot to suggest he may have seen exactly what happened, but it seems like the trauma of the experience was so great that Justin may have blocked certain things out, and even he isn't sure if some of the memories he has about the event were fantasy or reality. If there's one thing I question about the premeditated murder theory, it's the fact that Johnny was even left alive to begin with. If Jeremy's death was an accident, I can see the perpetrators allowing Johnny to live and intimidating him into staying silent. But if Jeremy was killed in cold blood, why not kill Johnny and dispose of his body as well? It seems like quite a risk to leave a living witness behind to a murder. Then again, if Johnny was sexually assaulted, maybe they figure the stigma would prevent him from coming forward and speaking about what happened. Sadly, if Johnny knew about Jeremy's fate, he is no longer around to share it, but it's unclear how many other witnesses might know the full truth. During one of her message board posts, Diane claimed that in the years following Jeremy's disappearance, Myrtle Point was hit with another major tragedy when four local teenagers who had been good friends with Jeremy were killed in a car accident. No one can be certain if any of these victims actually knew anything about Jeremy's case, but if they took important information to their graves, then that created a major snag in the investigation. Now, even though I've constantly pointed to Terry Lee Steinhoff as the most likely perpetrator, it must be stated that there's never been any direct evidence that he was responsible for Jeremy's disappearance. While we do have a reported sightings of Jeremy inside Steinhoff's truck, and of course Cecilia Fish's sighting of Steinhoff's cousin with blood on his clothing, but most of the evidence which implicates them is nothing more than uncorroborated rumors and hearsay, so I can see why no charges have ever been filed. Of course, within 2 years, Steinhoff went to prison for another murder, and I can't help but wonder about the timing of Steinhoff's sudden decision to plead no contest to the crime just 1 day before the Unsolved Mystery segment. It sounds like the state would have had a very strong circumstantial case against Steinhoff if he went to trial, and he probably would have been found guilty, so I can understand the legal reasoning for the decision. But looking through old newspaper articles about this case, I could see that the filming of the Unsolved Mystery segment was a pretty big story in the Coos County area. Even though Steinhoff was never actually referred to by name on the show, he may not have wanted the extra attention of going through a separate murder trial right after Jeremy's case was featured on national television, which may have motivated his decision to plead no contest and quietly begin serving his sentence in prison. Of course, investigators did try to question him about Jeremy while he was incarcerated, but he did not cooperate, as I'm sure he feared that being implicated in another murder might jeopardize his chances at parole. I know that when Steinhoff overdosed in 2007, investigators hoped that enough time had passed that people who were fearful of Steinhoff and had important information might have felt compelled to come forward. Sadly, this did not occur, but it's worth noting that he was not the only suspect. It seems like the most prevalent rumors were that Steinhoff, his cousin, and at least one or two other people were involved with what happened to Jeremy. So even though Steinhoff is currently deceased, there are still people out there who could be charged with this crime and lead the authorities to Jeremy's remains. Since they seem to cover their tracks fairly well, I think the key to finally solving this case is if there were any other witnesses who know the full truth but have yet to talk. It seems like most of the rumors in this case were spread by people who had fourth or fifth-hand information, but it's unclear how many people out there might have first-hand information which could potentially lead to an arrest if someone came forward. It seems like Jeremy's family have reached the point where bringing the perpetrators to justice is not the top priority. While they would like to attain full closure, after living with this for 3 decades, all they really care about is recovering Jeremy's remains and giving him a proper burial. So if you happen to have any information about the unsolved disappearance of Jeremy Bright, please contact the Coos County Sheriff's Office at 541-396-7800. That's 541-396-7800. But if you just have your own thoughts, feel free to leave me a comment or send me an email at robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. Now, the reminder that The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so if you have a moment, please visit patreon.com/thetrailwentcold to learn how you can support our podcast and become eligible for some pretty neat rewards. We've released some exclusive bonus episodes for our donors in tiers 2 and 3, and last month, we did a Halloween-themed bonus episode with supernatural overtones, which covered the murder of Teresita Bassa. So to learn more information, feel free to visit our Patreon page. I'd also like to take this moment to give a shout-out to our most recent listeners who have signed up to support us on Patreon, and they are Kristen Ellen T., Lizzie S., Lisa P., and Carrie S. And as you might know, I've been spending the past several weeks giving special shout-outs to our listeners who've been with us on Patreon for a while, and I've been doing so in increments of 20. So this week, I'd like to acknowledge Suzanne K., Victoria B., Consuelo M., Corrine H., Natalie S., Carrie K., Brendan M., Demetria S., Katie T., Lori B., Cassie C., Rebecca C., Kenny F., Michael S., Shelley G., Ryan L., Martin L., Jed F., Brooke A., and Sarah B. Thank you all so much for your support. I also just wanted to give another shout out to my supporters at the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit and the aforementioned Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online forum. Feel free to visit their thread about this case, as it contains a number of interesting posts from people closely connected to this story. I need to provide a big thanks to Miguel Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composes the eerie music you hear on every episode. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or leave us a rating or a review on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play Music, or Spotify. So have yourself a good week, and join me next Wednesday for a brand new episode of The Trail Went Cold. We'll be right back.